Okay. Thanks, David, and thanks for this opportunity, and thank you everybody for coming here. So enjoy your lunch, those who brought it here, and I'll try to go slowly and more or less on a general physics level. Fluid mechanics and in general, turbulence in particular is a part of physics, engineering, and mathematics, and it has very many aspects. It's not a problem. It's a huge field which involves many, many problems and aspects. But I'll try to focus today on what is really interesting from a very general and fundamental physics perspective. So it will be only small, relatively small aspect of turbulence. But this is something which is related to its fundamental nature as a state of system with many degrees of freedom very far away from equilibrium. So this is, if you wish, a definition. We understand turbulence as a state which is, has many degrees of freedom deviated far away from equilibrium. As Leo Tolstoy wrote in Anna Karenina, all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. So every equilibrium system is practically the same for a physicist. It has Gibbs distribution. They all are the same. Now, there are infinitely many ways to make you unhappy or to deviate a system from equilibrium. And at that point, it seems that it's not anymore a physics problem, because if there are so many ways to create an equilibrium state, then it's something which belongs to engineering with its particular emphasis on particular cases, and not to physics, because physics is more or less interested in the laws of nature, in something which are universal. It's not that exactly so, because we know that very near equilibrium, all this beautiful Onsager science in the linear, small deviation from equilibrium, there is still a lot of universality over there. But as we deviate further away from equilibrium, it seems that we are losing this universality. And then we start to ask, if we go really far, far away from equilibrium, is there any ultimate state of being far away from equilibrium, which is to a large extent is independent, or independent to some extent, from the way that we actually reached this state? And that's where the most fundamental aspect of turbulence appear, and I'll talk today about this. So what are the universal features that we can distinguish? Even though the way I define turbulence, there is nothing fluid mechanical of it. We can talk about optical, work on optical turbulence or spin wave turbulence, or any system could be deviated far away from equilibrium. Fluids are naturally very easily deviated away from equilibrium. That's why they provide most of the examples. So I'll just mostly will give examples from fluid turbulence. And here I'll start just from writing few equations. So equation which describes the motion of a fluid, let's say I consider incompressible fluid with a unit density. It's an equation that describes it extremely simple. It takes acceleration equal to force. That's all fluid mechanics. So it tells you that if you write that acceleration of a fluid particle, which in the standing reference frame is something like this, it's equal to minus gradient of a pressure and viscous friction force that acts on it. Because if system is incompressible, the pressure is actually could be eliminated if we take a divergence of this equation, and we know that divergence of u is equal to zero, that's incompressibility, then basically we have an equation from which we can eliminate pressure. And this is an equation on velocity. And this is so-called Navier-Stokes equation. It's a basic equation. It says something very, very simple. I have an equation of motion. I have an inertia term, which is a nonlinear. I have a viscous friction term, which is linear. All fluid mechanics is about competition between these two terms. Inertia tries to keep motion, and friction tries to stop it. But it's much less trivial than in the mechanics of particles, because friction produces vorticity. And that's how all the turbulence starts. But basically, that's all we have. Technically speaking, we can solve this equation. We can solve turbulence. Now we cannot solve this equation. Now we can consider even simpler version of it. If we consider compressible one-dimensional turbulence, imagine that we have a pipe. We put loudspeaker and we produce a lot of noise, and it propagates along the pipe, and it's practically a one-dimensional system. And in this case, we can write equation not for a vector field, but for a scalar field, which is called Bürger's equation. It's, in a sense, has all the features of of this equation. It has inertia, it has friction, it's nonlinear, and we can now try to describe turbulence in the framework of this equation. Or we can make even simpler problem. We can consider a scalar field theta, which is passive. It's just transported by some given velocity field, and it's subject to the diffusion. And again, considering turbulence means putting in the right-hand side some sources which produce and which deviate system far away from equilibrium. Now, we cannot solve none of this equation. Even in this equation, when we assume that V is a given function, let's say random flow, which not a subject of this equation, which we cannot solve either, but we just say, okay, let's assume we know this is a Gaussian field, white in time, Gaussian, all moments are very simple. Can we find the statistics of theta in this case? The answer is we can. Now, the moment that we cannot solve the problem, we try to guess the answer. So how we're going about guessing? We're interested, let's say, in describing the statistics of this velocity vector u, statistics of its fluctuation. What we expect that if we put some force in the right-hand side, it start driving the flow would be unstable, it will produce a very, very chaotic and random pattern both in time and in space, and we want to guess the properties of these statistics. And how we do it? We came out with the idea of a cascade. Then we say, okay, if we, let's say, produce a large-scale flow, and this large-scale flow is starting to be unstable and produce some other scales, then maybe it could be that what actually this flow does, as long as it works on the scales much larger than where the second this friction term, which is a Laplacian and in higher derivative. So what is the typical, if you are interested in the, let's say, velocity difference between point 1 and point 2. Here we have some velocity u1, here we have some velocity u2. We may consider the difference, and it's a random variable. Now we can project it on the, let's say, consider its longitudinal component. And let's call it delta u. So we may ask, what is the probability of finding delta u at a given distance r? Well, in principle, I mean, this is a vector and this is a vector, but we already took it as a scalar, but this is still a vector. We now want to guess the form of this probability distribution. But to guess it, we first ask, what are the symmetries of this probability distribution? What we expect it, for example, if we take the movie of turbulence and screen it backwards in time, which means we make time reversal. Is this probability, is this function is symmetric with respect to time reversibility? When we make a reversal, all velocity just change into opposite. So we ask if this is the case. Second, we may ask if this distribution is isotropic. Well, generally it should not. We put here some forcing, and this forcing definitely breaks isotropy of space. But then we ask maybe at a very, very small distances, where this distance is much less than the typical scale of our force, the turbulence will be locally isotropic. So we ask if this is actually a function not of, let's say, four variables in three-dimensional space, but a function of only two variables. All these symmetries are our attempt to diminish the number of variables with which we work, because if we cannot solve the problem, at least we can try to measure this property. But to measure function of four variables, it's a completely different game from measuring function of two variables. Okay? And this just reduces space by. But then we want even more. We ask, can we have this function of two variables to be actually function of a single variable? That's what experimentalists would love. Then you change some parameter, you measure something, and you get the whole description, at least in terms of experimental data. So how we would get this function of two variable as a function of only single variable? We assume scale invariance. And scale invariance means that this is dimensionally 1 over delta u, just because the integral over delta u would give unity, and it's some function, now dimensionless function, of delta u in some r in the power. If this is true, this would mean that this distribution is scale invariant, and then we diminished all our variables to just a single variable, this one. Okay? And then we try to guess and get it. Now, again, pumping or forcing or vessel size definitely breaks scale invariance. Also, we know that there is a friction term, which we somehow try to neglect, and it works at a very small scale. But we ask if we really consider these distances, which are much, much smaller than the forcing scale, but still on such a scale in which friction does not work effectively, could we really have this distribution scale invariant? And what is the value of this parameter h, which would be then the main, the scaling exponent of the theory? And that's how this cascade idea helps us to find this parameter. We say, okay, if what turbulence does, it actually makes a transfer of energy from a given scale to some other scale, then we can estimate energy at a given scale r, again, by delta u taken at this, let me put it here, a subscript just to stress that this delta u is taken at a scale r. If I take it squared, that would be an energy contained, roughly speaking, in the vortices of the size r. Now, if I divide it by typical time, which it takes for such vortex to make a turnover, or for the typical motion having scale r and velocity delta u, that would be a typical time on the scale r that takes for, it's called turnover time. But intuitively, this is the only combination which you can make with the dimensionality of time out of r and delta u. So this would be energy divided by typical time. That would be a rate of energy transfer through a given scale r. And then we say if this is constant, let's call it epsilon. And then it immediately tells us that if this is so, then we know what is the third moment of this quantity. We expect the third moment behaving somehow as epsilon r. Okay? So that's basically the idea, which goes back to Kolmogorov, 1941, and actually some qualitative idea were even before, and then it was reinvented several times, including Anzager and Geisenberg and other people, and Prandtl, as we now know, and there are, well, in a different form. I don't want to go into, there are a lot of subtleties who invented what, but this is the basic idea. First of all, it immediately tells you that this is not true, because this is a third moment and it is non-zero. The third moment is not invariant with respect to time reflection. Well, of course, cascade means time reversibility. It means that somehow energy goes in some direction and then it is dissipated there. So even when you consider scales which are visibly uninfluenced by friction, for example, or by any other dissipative mechanism, the fact that you have a third moment tells you that if you screen a movie of turbulence and then screen it backwards in time, that an expert, like any turbulent expert in the science, will tell you that this is the wrong direction. The movie actually should go this way. Okay? So first of all, this tells us. Second, it tells us, okay, if it is so, but this still true, that would mean immediately then h is equal 1/3. Because the third moment, let me define a moments of this quantity, which we call structure functions, and they should be some coefficients depending on n, which we do not know, and which we expect to be non-universal, namely depending on the real statistics of force which acts on it. And then, because it depends on r, it could be only power law, but generally there are some exponents. Now, if this is true, then of course this would be an integral over delta u, p 1 over delta u, and p of delta u over r to 1/3. Well, that I can actually write it like this, according to this statement. And that would be r to the power n over 3. So in a sense, scale invariance tells us that those exponents must be just linear functions of n with a slope 1/3. Or in other terms, it tells us that this function is scale invariant. And then we go to the lab, we measure, and it is not so. Namely, if we measure this quantity, let me put it somewhere here, zeta n is a function of n, just a scaling exponent of moments in turbulence. I'm a relatively old person in our program. I still remember time when I was kind of doubting it, and I was kind of trying to build theory, trying to show that they really n over 3. But in many decades that passed since then, we're now absolutely sure that, of course, the third moment has an exponent 1. It passes through this point. We pretty well know that it was not this straight line. It actually has a higher slope here, and it goes like this. That's more or less, until the n number 10, we're more or less confident about these numbers. The better we measure them, the more more statistics we have, more rare events we actually register, the more those numbers deviate. So let's say 20 years, they were a little bit closer, but already still far from n over 3. And then the question is, what are those numbers? Can we understand? This 2 is not 2/3, that probably most widely known statement about turbulence is 5/3 law, which is a Fourier transform of this exponent, which would be 2/3 if this would Kolmogorov. This is not true. This is a very famous, absolutely incorrect statement. It's kind of useful because the true number is not far from 2/3, but it's incorrect. So what is this number? The real number, not 2/3. What it tells us, where it comes from. This number, unity, we know what it is. It's a constant flux, and it's true. The third moment has a scaling exponent equal to unity. Then we ask, okay, so what about this simpler problem? Can we at least get numbers for example, for this problem? This, after all, is something which we can solve. I mean, with a zero right-hand side, it's a Burger's equation in one dimension. It's completely integrable. You can make Kolb substitution and turn it into diffusion equation. You can solve it with arbitrary initial condition. When we put force here, it's kind of a little bit more complicated. When this force is white noise, which means that we put our Burger's equation in contact with thermostat, with a force which is noise in time, noise in space, we still can, it's KPZ equation, and we can say a lot about it. And in a sense, it is integrable. But when we put here forcing, which is a large scale forcing, and then we cannot solve this equation, but we can still make many things about it. But the main thing is that physics of it is extremely simple. Physics of it is that every initial perturbation of U or something large scale distribution that forcing create would actually go into something that would be a set of shock waves separated by relatively smooth intervals. Now, for such distribution, you don't need to solve equation to get these numbers. It's pretty simple. If now I would take delta U in the power n, and this n is less than unity, let me put it here. Again, I am interested in, let me now call it for Burgers, let's say delta U in the power n would be x, because it's a one-dimensional problem, in some power which I call xi n. And those xi are pretty simple to get, because when n is less than unity, the moments would be determined by this smooth interval. And here, delta u would be proportional to x in the power n. So it's like this. But when I'm interested in high moments, then definitely shocks would give you the main contribution. So you take the interval of the length x. This is the interval length x. And you ask, what is the value of delta u, let's say, to the power 4 or 5 or 6? Then it's clear that it will be this difference between these two points in the power n times the probability of finding shock in this interval x. But the probability to find the shock at a given interval is just the length of this interval, because shocks are more or less equally distributed. It's kind of subtle mathematics. You need to say that it's a dilute set of shocks, and it's for smooth forcing, it could be actually all shown. So that would be unity, which means that all the higher moments will be proportional to the first power. So see, it's like Navier-Stokes. For third moment, it's unity. Again, it's the same basic physics applies to Burgers as well. You have energy divided by typical time equal to epsilon. Third moment must have exponent equal to 1, and it does. all the other moments as an extreme caricature of this curve, which means that they behave, well, if I use color, then burgers here would be like this. Which, roughly speaking, is what Navier-Stokes does. We now, at least I personally believe that infinite space dimensionality, Navier-Stokes does this exactly like Burger does. Okay? So we know these numbers. These numbers are just co-dimension of the most singular object. What is this number unity? It's a fact that even if I would consider it in a multidimensional space, I have shock wave. Shock wave is a surface of co-dimension one with respect to the full dimensionality D. And the fact that this exponent is unity, so it's last sentence lost for posterity. So that's basically a simple understanding where this anomalous, as we say, anomalous scaling comes in Burger's equation. All these numbers are just equal to the same number one, and this number is a co-dimension of our shock. Okay? Yes, David.
You made a statement about what happens for D equals infinity. You said it becomes...
The Navier-Stokes, what we believe, and what, for example, already we have a numerical even evidence to it, and when D grows, this white curve actually goes down here and up here. And what I personally believe, even though I cannot prove it, that in infinite dimensional space, Navier-Stokes, incompressible Navier-Stokes, would have scaling exponent exactly like Burger's.
So that's confusing to me.
It is.
So because Burger's is D equals 1.
Yeah.
Saying 1 is equal to infinity.
Yes.
And 2, D equals infinity usually had mean field theory, which is what I thought naive scaling would be.
Yes. I actually made this remark, and I was not going to elaborate because we're now going into very... But I'll briefly answer, and then maybe at the end I'll return to it. First of all, Burgers could be considered in any dimensions. It's just a potential. You can consider potential Navier-Stokes, and you can consider Burgers in any dimension. Doesn't make strict physical sense. But you're right, posing problem like this. What is important is that Burgers is compressible, so it creates shocks. In incompressible fluid, you cannot create shock, unless you go to infinite dimensionality, where you can create almost shock in one dimension, because D minus one other direction would take the part of the divergence of V which you're creating here. On another way, incompressibility is just one condition put on D components. As D go into infinity, this condition is getting less and less important. That's why I believe... Anyway, but let me skip it now this and just return to this question, because what we're now discussing is a breakdown of this symmetry. So this symmetry is broken both for Burgers and for Navier-Stokes. Probability distribution is not scale invariant. Those numbers aren't linear function of n, and for Burgers we understand it just from a simple viewpoint, which is called structures on jargon. So we understand what are the physical objects that exist inside, they are shock waves. And we understand what is this numbers, this is numbers just co-dimension of this object. We can actually explain the anomalous scaling in Burgers into other language. This equation, I mean, being completely integrable, it has an infinite number of integral of motion in the inviscid limit, not only u squared, which we implicitly were making cascade of u squared here. But for example, you can take u4, and it's also conserved in the inviscid limit, and every shock burns a finite amount of u4, u6, u8, any integral of motion. Then you can say that all these numbers are equal to unity because there are infinite number of fluxes of u squared, u4, u6, u8. Okay? So in a sense, Burgers is such a perfect system that even though we cannot solve it, we can explain it on two alternative languages. One is a language of structures. We know what a physical object inside. And another language is extra integrals of motion. And here I want to notice you something very interesting which make turbulence very different from usual physics. In usual physics, we get used to, we have symmetry, we have conservation law. We have conservation law, we have symmetry. Here we have extra conservation law, we have broken symmetry because of it. That's a lesson, and that's kind of, that's what makes this far from equilibrium states very different. But we have a third problem, and here we have a completely different way of breaking the same symmetry, namely the scale invariance. Again, the setting is practically like this, so we take this system, theta could be temperature or just color, and we assume that we produce fluctuation of this theta on a very large scale, then inhomogeneous velocity field would it stretch and fold and produce small scale structures which this diffusive term would burn. And that would be a mechanism of the cascade of this quantity theta, and again we can make the same assumptions about what would be a statistics of delta theta measured on the distance r, and we may ask if it's 1 over delta theta and some another function of delta theta and r in the power b, let's say. And again, what we find out that it is not this, that if you take the moments of delta theta in the power n, then there will be again some Cn, there will be distance r, and there will be exponents sigma of n, and those exponents, if I would have third color, would be somewhere here. And then we know that it actually goes into constant asymptotics at large, and which we don't know for velocity, by the way, which we suspect, but we don't know. Okay, and then what we invented, and where is Boris Schreiman? Boris, yeah, one who actually invented this, the way of looking at these numbers, and this is a way which is completely different from the way that we looked into Burger's, which was kind of the only case that we knew how to get those numbers. And this was the way which kind of introduced a kind of a new idea of statistical integrals of motion. And I spent some time trying now to elucidate this idea. In a sense, the simple way to look into this equation is to say, let's consider it coarse-grained over large scale so that we can forget about this term. And then we can have here some forcing. So this would be a very simple equation if you write it in so-called Lagrangian reference frame. So along the trajectories of fluid particles, namely trajectories that are divided by the equation dr dt is equal to v taken of r at time t. So along these trajectories, I have a very simple equation and have here some forcing. And it's very easy to integrate it. It means that the theta is an integral of my forcing along the trajectory taken at time t over time t dt at some time t capital time t capital. That's a straightforward, even though it's not trivial because r depends on v. V is supposed to be known field. It's so-called passive scalar problem, which means that I assume that I know about v everything, and because we're interested in fundamental properties, we can take v as simple as possible Gaussian random field. Okay? And then if we'll be interested in the moments, let's say, of this field, taken at two different points, or in differences as we are interested, then we know what it would be. It would be moments of f taken on trajectory 1 and f taken on trajectory 2, and then integrate it over time. Now, this is Gaussian field forcing. Okay, so we can average over this Gaussian field. And we can say that this would be, after we make this average and this double average over velocity statistics and of the field statistics. I'm not trying to fool you now that I'm really presenting a theory. I'm giving you kind of a sketch of it to show the argument. But that would be a correlation function. Let me write it like symbolically. Correlation function of force integrated over time. And it actually tells me, but it's integrated over the trajectory. So I have two particles. I want to know what is the correlation between them at this point. I need to integrate into the past. They were somewhere in the past. And this integration would persist until this correlation function turns into zero, namely until they are out of the correlation radius of the forcing. So in a sense, it tells me a simple thing. The correlation function of my passive scalar is a time to fluid particle spent inside the force correlation radius. You want to know 3-point correlation function, 4-point correlation function. That will be correlation time of 4 particles, how much time they spent inside force correlation radius. And basically, this formalism of Lagrangian integral over trajectories, which Boris and me and some other people did in the 90s, this is this picture of times. The correlation function are times. Now, if you're interested in these moments, for example, let's consider moments like theta 1 minus theta 2 cube. Okay? That would be something which would be theta 1 squared theta 2 minus theta 2 theta 1 theta 2 squared. Or, remember that if I speak on this language, I take my points not exactly at the same point because I want to neglect diffusivity. I need to have so-called point splitting in a sense that this would be a correlation function taken like this. This is point one and this is point two. And this would be a correlation function taken like that. Again, point one, point two. That's the difference. They are different because this distance is finite. This distance must be larger than the diffusion scale. So what it tells me is that such a moment is proportional to the time during which I can distinguish this realization from that realization. This time, when I look at the past, points moved somewhere, but this would be different realization after a while. So after a while, I start distinguishing them. So in a sense, I realize that this exponent of this third moment and all the exponents of other moments are actually times that I can distinguish one triangle from another triangle. And then I ask how this time scales with the size of the triangle. Okay? And those numbers, those sigma n's, are scaling time with which different geometries are kind of forgotten, with which my statistics of a given triangle turns eventually to some kind of equal distribution of points of a sphere. And they are different for 3 points, 4 points, 5 points, and they depend on the space dimensionality. But what is more important, one can build out of it a new type of integral of motion. You can ask, could I build any integral of motion out of 2 points and distance between them in the turbulent flow, or in Fabronian diffusion, let's say? The answer is, yes, you can, but it should be a function of the distance r of degree of homogeneity zero. Any function of a distance r between 2 points which has a non-zero degree of homogeneity would grow because r on average grow points. Now, if you take 3 points, can I build a function of the distances r12, r23, r13? Can I build a function of 3 distances which actually does not depend on time on average? It's called martingale. Of course I can. Well, first of all, I can simply take something like r12 squared minus r23 squared. On average, this does not grow. That's not interesting because I want something which is symmetric on the cyclic permutation. But of course I can do it. I can just take any harmonic polynomial of these distances, and I know that Fabronian diffusion harmonic polynomial is a zero mode of Laplacian, and Laplacian actually is evolution operator of Fabronian diffusion. The same we can do for turbulence using these times. If I know how actually triangle loses its geometry, I can build some function which would be some distances in some power, let's say sigma 3, times some function of some angles. And with time, all distances would grow, but the function of angles would decay, and it decay by a law which is exactly given by this. And this would be an integral of motion. So in a sense, what we discovered is that if you want to know what are the scaling exponents of your scalar differences, you go and measure this statistical integral. What is the quantity made out of 3 points which has on average its value conserved? And this is what we call zero modes, but then you can also call the statistical integral of motions or martingales or whatever. Now, after we see all this, then we go back to Navier-Stokes and then we ask whether it from this type of Burgers, where we have extra dynamical conservation law, or it's from this type of a passive scalar, where this extra conservation law, they aren't dynamical. They are conservation law which only conserved in statistical sense. In a sense, martingale is not even a conservation law. It's something which does not grow and does not decay on average. Okay? And we cannot answer this question definitely, but what we believe is that for Navier-Stokes equation, the nature of these numbers, of these exponents, is of the type of passive scalar type. For example, if you ask, what is this quantity which determines the spectrum of turbulence? Okay, so if I'm asking now about delta U squared for Navier-Stokes, and it's R zeta 2, so what is this number zeta 2? After a Fourier transform it, it would give me, if that would be 2/3, would it give me 5/3 for the spectrum? So what I personally believe, what this number tells me, it tells me the following. If I take two points in a fluid, one may ask, this is two-point object. How one had geometry related to the two-point object? You remember, for scalar, we needed something starting from three points. But now I have vectors attached to these points. I have U1, and I have U2, and I have R1, 2. Now I have geometry. I have actually two vectors, and the third vector is here. What happens with time is that this distance grows, but the correlation between these two vectors, angular correlation between these two vectors, decreases with time. So one can build an integral of motion which would consist out of these angles, theta, well, phi 1 minus phi 2. It's actually a three-dimensional picture, but just for simplicity. Out of this angle and this distance. And this conservation law has a non-trivial scaling in R. And this is the scaling which is actually the scaling of the energy of the energy distribution in turbulence. This is a very important lesson that, simply speaking, we always thought that turbulence is about cascade. That it is about bringing energy and, from one end to another end. And it's true. This moment, third moment, is about cascade. And it's non-zero, and it breaks time, time reversal invariance, and it's... But it's only one moment. All the other moments are determined by absolutely different conservation laws. And these conservation laws are of geometrical nature. And they had nothing to do with cascade. This is about something completely different. So in a sense, this is probably the main lesson that we learned in here about broken symmetries in turbulence. And maybe only one historical remark I want to make, that this is probably the first example of anomaly in turbulence, in a sense that this time reversibility is broken no matter what is the value of the symmetry breaking factor. Here, viscosity, of course, breaks time reversibility. It's a friction. But when nu goes to zero, this value stays finite. And that was done by Kolmogorov 10 years before Schwinger. So this is the first example of anomaly in turbulence. Anomaly is when the symmetry remains broken even when the symmetry breaking factor goes to zero. This is the first example of symmetry breaking. Okay, and now the remaining 15 minutes, I'll try to tell you something completely opposite to it. How turbulence can really produce new symmetry, which is in a sense somehow unexpected. But for this, we need to look in the opposite direction. And this opposite direction is called inverse cascade. And inverse cascade is probably the most unexpected and interesting development that happened in turbulence since Kolmogorov, and it was actually invented by Bob Kreitman. So when we look into this relation, it actually doesn't tell us which way the cascade goes. Whether it goes from large scale towards small scale, or it goes from small scale towards large scale. Also, this equation, Navier-Stokes equation, makes sense not only in three dimensions, it makes sense in two dimensions. In one dimension, it does not make sense because you don't have incompressible one-dimensional flow except constant. But in two dimensions, it makes perfect sense. What is in two dimensions new here? I'm moving from right to left according to Hebrew writing. So, in two dimensions, one can introduce omega, which is called vorticity, and which is a curl of velocity, and it's now a scalar. It only has one component vertical because the velocity is in the plane. And then this equation could be written as an equation for transport of vorticity. Okay? Now, if I don't have viscosity, that would be all. The curl, I took curl of this equation, my gradient of pressure disappeared, okay? And so if there is no viscosity, this is just this equation, which means that d omega dt is equal to zero. It's called Kelvin theorem. In this case, it just tells you that every particle conserves, vorticity is frozen into a flow, and every particle conserves vorticity. In particularly, the omega squared over dr is constant, is an integral of motion. So you see, I have two quadratic integrals of motion. Vorticity squared, which is called entropy, and energy, which is also constant. This is kinetic energy of incompressible fluid. It's an integral of u squared. Now, what I realize immediately, that if in my Fourier in k space, I would have forcing which acts on some particular k, let's say I produce vortices of a given size, then it's clear that I cannot have energy being cascading to large k. Because if I have at some very large k, when my viscosity goes to zero, this wave number where absorption happens goes to larger and larger k, but when I would have a finite dissipation of energy, I would have an infinite dissipation of vorticity because it's curl. So in a sense, this is an integral in k spaces, k squared, uk squared, dk. And then I have uk squared dk, which immediately tells me that I must have two cascades in this, because I have two integrals of motion, they must go as separate waves. It's my entropy, omega squared, it can go towards large k, because absorbing finite amount of entropy over here would mean absorbing zero amount of energy over there when k is getting very large. But energy then must go this way and make an inverse cascade. Now you ask, what is the scaling of this inverse cascade is supposed to be? Well, of course, I mean, in this argument, the space dimensionality never actually mattered. And miracle, in 2D, it happened to be true. So what we discover empirically is that the probability distribution of delta U and R in 2D is really 1/3.
That conservation law is an assumption, there is no dissipation, right?
Exactly, but exactly on the same assumption as this conservation law. They both, energy is also dissipated by viscosity, and vorticity is dissipated. So they are conserved under the same assumption of zero viscosity. And if you have very small viscosity, then this assumption turns into the assumption of cascade. We say, of course, viscosity dissipates energy, but at a very, very large wave numbers. Or vorticity. And then we realize that it's actually vorticity which is dissipated by viscosity and not velocity, because velocity must go towards large scale. That what, by the way, in quasi-two-dimensional flow produce all these huge vortices which people like photograph everywhere. So in a sense, physically it's kind of natural that we have a scale invariance for inverse cascade and we don't have scale invariance for direct cascade, because just on a simple intuitive level, it's like this. What is this inverse cascade? We have a small scale forcing. In the lab we have a thin layer of fluid, a small magnet below it, and we put currents through it, and then it creates all these kind of small scale vortices. It goes towards produce larger and larger vortices, and as we are interested in the statistics of large vortices, we effectively average over many forcing scales. And also these large vortices, they are slow, which means that we effectively average over many forcing time. Now, if we have a large scale force, and that's what Landau said to Kolmogorov in 1944, that if you have a large scale force and we're interested in the small scale statistics, we're always inside the correlation radius of the forcing. We're always sensitive to the statistics of forcing. Actually, these numbers, they tell us how sensitive we are, how much information we need to know about this large scale statistics. The answer is infinite amount of information we need to know about large scale statistics. But the inverse cascade is okay, because it's kind of, it's effectively self-averaging procedure. It doesn't make it Gaussian though, but it makes it scale invariant. And at that point, we really started to be greedy, and we asked, could we have more than scale invariant, namely conformal invariance? And that's the last subject that I briefly touch here, is that conformal invariance is the generalization of scale invariance for a non-uniform stretching. Scale invariance tells you that you can take your picture of turbulence, enlarge it, and blur a resolution, and the statistic will be the same. Then you ask, could I do it like this? Could I, let's say, enlarge it here and stress it there, but from here to there go in a smooth way? namely making a conformal transform of my domain and asking if my statistics would be scale, would be invariant with respect to this. Conformal transformation is a transformation which preserves angles but stretch distances. It's something that people invented it by doing maps. When you do map and you want to, you know, make an object which is like this into a plain sheet of paper, then you need, and then you ask what is more important, and then you realize if you want to discover America, it's more important to know the direction, namely the angle, and it's better not to know the distance. And so that's how this conformal invariance was invented. Now, in a sense, conformal invariance, particularly in 2D, it's a very powerful thing because it's an infinite dimensional group. Any analytic function makes a conformal transform, and it imposes infinite amount of restraints of your statistics. So if you know that your statistic is conformally invariant, it's a very powerful statement. It gives you a lot of information. And then surprisingly, what we discovered empirically, we have no so far theoretical idea that in this particular problem, and in a related family of problems, we actually now have an infinite family of turbulences of that type with an inverse cascade, which all are not only scale invariant, but have a very important element, which is conformally invariant. And I'll just say about it a few words. First of all, on this language, these were lines when omega equal to zero. They are naturally very important. For example, if you look at the atmospheric turbulence, you have vortices which rotate in one direction, it's positive omega, and another direction, negative omega. Those are called cyclones and anticyclones, because the direction, there is a direction of Earth's rotation, so which is opposite is called anticyclone. Now, the lines between them are very important. It's weather changes. So we're kind of naturally curious about the behavior of the lines. They are fractals in this turbulence. And then we ask, what can we say about the statistics of the slides? If we're only interested in the boundary between omega plus and omega minus, like spin system. We only say, I'm not interested in what is this omega, large or small. I know that it has this scale invariant statistics. I'm interested in the line between, it's like domain wall in Eisenk model. What is the statistics of this domain wall? And that's what we discovered quite unexpectedly, that these lines belong to this very interesting class, which is called Schramm-Lohner evolution. And I'll just spend last 5 minutes on telling you about this class, because this is something which is definitely one of the most important things now in mathematics, because they already given few fields medals for it. But I believe it's also important for physics. What is the idea? The idea was invented by German mathematician Lohner long ago. Let's say you have a half plane, and you consider a curve in this half plane. So you can describe this curve as a parametrization of it. It's just a given coordinate of it at every moment in time in this plane. But you can make it differently. You can map this half plane outside of this curve, which means half plane minus curve, speaking mathematically, just into half plane. Well, any domain could be mapped into domain. This map would have only one singular point. It would be this tip of this curve. It would be mapped somewhere on the boundary. You know, like when we learn complex analysis, consider it as a slit, and then you can absorb this slit into the boundary by making a map. That's what conformal transform do. Now, as this curve moves about in space, this point here would move somehow along this line. So the Lohner idea was very powerful, that instead of thinking about curves on a plane, you can think about motion of a point on a straight line. This is a very powerful statement. Okay? And it's called Lohner evolution. And this law of motion, this point zeta, as a function, let's call it xi, as a function of time, completely encodes this curve. That's the idea. You take a point, you move it by a straight line, the law by which it moves completely encodes some curve in space. And then, 80 years later, Israeli mathematician Schramm came out and asked what would make this curve having a conformally invariant statistics. The moment you ask, it's already the answer is almost evident, and then it took people some 20, 25 years to prove it case by case. Almost every proof got a Fields Medal to the guy who did it. And it's not as evident as one may guess, but intuitively for physics, I remember when I first heard about it, we actually were assistant professor with Schramm at the same time, and nobody actually understood what happened. But at some point I understood it, and it was like, like a light, because, well, of course, it will be a Brownian, simple Brownian walk here, because a Brownian walk is something which forgets itself every moment, and conformally invariant statistics is something which is locally scale invariant. You take it locally, and it's this locally scale invariant, and in some other place it just doesn't know about it. And then what you see that any set of curves is now determined by this function. This function now, if you're interested in conformal curves, is something which has a diffusive growth, let's say minus squared, and it just grows linearly with time. It's some kind of dimensionless time which is related to parametrization of the curve. And we have a dimensionless number here, and all the models, for example, domain wall in Ising would correspond to kappa equal to 3. And then it's deep and interesting mathematics which relates the bulk properties of the field to the lines, and I'm not going to go into it. What I now want to tell is that we now have a family of fluid mechanical models of that type. And in this family, we have these curves belonging to these SLE classes with different kappas. And in particular, the first that we discovered for two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation would correspond to kappa equal to 6, and it's correspond to probably the simplest class of critical curves, which is called percolation line. So if you have a landscape, which is a short correlated in space, and it has positive and negative part, and you start filling it by water, then when water level is low, you have more lakes, and it's always a probability to go from one infinity to other infinity is to walk by shore. But at some point, the probability of sailing and of walking is equal. At that point, you create infinite cluster, which goes from infinity to infinity, and the statistics of this cluster, for absolutely unknown to us reason, are the same as the statistics of vorticity lines in turbulence. Even though, in turbulence, let me remind you, we have this Kolmogorov scaling, and it means that if I take vorticity at point zero and vorticity at point r, it is not short correlated, it's actually r minus 4/3. And this is slowly decaying correlation, and it should not be percolation in any way, if that would be a Gaussian field. So in a sense, what I would like to finish here is...
So this is empirical.
This is empirical with accuracy which went from 5% to 3%, but not better. So let's say this is a statement made with a 3% accuracy, which required absolutely heroic numerical effort. And there are some experimental data, and particularly unique here is for other systems which are related to it. We now find this SLE in many systems, apart from just standard critical phenomena. Maybe I'll just list a few of them. We have, for example, wave function in chaotic billiards. Just you have a domain, you solve Laplace equation, Helmholtz equation, whatever. You consider high level, and then you find, again, nodal lines of this wave function would be like this. It's actually inspired by our work. In some spin glasses, Matthew Hastings found SLE for domain walls. And then, you know, quintessential fractal object, which is a coast lines. We now, I mean, the coast line was something which kind of prompted the invention of a fractal. What is actually discovered by Guido Buffetta, who is coming next week here, is that there are two classes of coast lines. Well, it's known that there are two classes of coast lines. One are rocky coast lines, and another kind of sandy coast lines. And rocky coast lines belong to this class, SLE. Other coast lines do not belong to this class. Nobody have any idea why, but rocky coast lines, again, with some kind of, it's empirical statement, with some accuracy, they belong to this class SLE. Okay? Now, let me finish by just saying some moral of what we learned about symmetries in turbulence. So instead of solving problem, we try to guess an answer. We assume some symmetry. We know that turbulence is never time reversal invariant. Even inverse cascade is still a cascade. It knows the direction. It always goes, it always has a third moment. Third moment means that there is no time reversibility. Isotropy at small scale exists, but it somehow attained slower than we expected. Scale invariance is broken in all direct cascades with a qualification, the direct cascade that take a finite time to reach infinity, scale invariance, again empirically, always present in the inverse cascade, some features of some inverse cascade are conformally invariant. That's more or less state of the art for today.
Any questions?
Could you clarify this last very important equation in circle there? Because you were talking about, for instance, vorticity and vortices, which are rotating in opposite direction. And if there are some interactions between them, this must work only at very large distances.
Yes,
because at short distance you may have kind of alternation.
Yes, my vorticity is a continuous field. It's not everything is classical here. There is no quantization of vorticity, so it's a continuous field, and this is a nonlinear field with correlation. And this tells me how it's correlated. This correlation between vorticity and different points decays slowly, decays by power law. This power law is an exact consequence of this statement of the Kolmogorov law. But the point is that despite this, either lines of this field, zero lines, still belongs to the percolation class, which requires short correlation of bulk field. I scared people by so many broken symmetries.
Formula for sigma n?
Yes, we derive formula for sigma n in the limits. In a sense, your intuition about infinite dimensionality, by the way, is right for passive scalar. For infinite dimensionality, in infinite dimensionality, any scalar is a Gaussian field, and passive scalar is something which is brought from d direction and it's Gaussian. So what we did long ago, we solved this problem at infinite dimensionality when it's Gaussian, and then we calculated the sigma n's as a correction in 1 over d. And what other people did is they consider some other limit of a very non-smooth velocity and calculated them perturbatively. And then, again, Lebedev, who was here last month, calculated in the limit of very large n and have shown that it's a constant, which is again important. So that at least we know that for passive scalar, this is a constant here, just like in Burgers. And this again, of course, is a co-dimension of the most singular object, this constant. Yes.
So, can you summarize under what conditions we have a direct cascade versus inverse cascade?
We usually have direct cascade when we have a single integral of motion. The moment we have two integrals of motion, both quadratic, we have two cascades. So, but in a sense, in nature, there are many systems which have at least two integrals of motion.
So, in 3D, don't you have conservation of angular momentum?
Angular momentum is something which is not sign definite. Here what is important that this is positive and this is positive. In any higher dimension we cannot build this integral of motion. Even though in any even dimension in 4, 6, 8, we have analogs of vorticity. You can have determinants which are, but they aren't sign definite. And they don't impose any restriction on u squared. Now here we have quadratic positive integral of motion, which now does not allow energy to flow towards large wave numbers. It's only in 2D. But there is a whole family of such models. I mean, magnetized plasma, rotating fluids, all this.
There is time, even in your time, there is time in your equations, but all the moments you considered are
single time.
Equal time. Anything particular in
different times?
Paulo's and things like that.
Yes, there is a lot of empirical material here. In a sense, one can translate all this into the time domain. So the statement about third moment would be the statement about the time derivative of the velocity difference between two points. The cascade means that it's kind of d over dt of delta v squared is some constant. And but much less, well, at least theoretically, there is no such simple picture which would translate, which would give us at least qualitative understanding of the exponents of the moments in time domain. At least we had such a picture, and we now know it's to be wrong. And there is no correct picture in its stand. Even so, it probably could be developed. But I don't know such picture. But in space, this is single time, and it's kind of, that's what we understand.
Could you comment, please? Some time ago, Polyakov wrote a paper in which he argued there is some relation between turbulence and conformal invariance. Could you comment?
Yes. It was 93, and there was kind of, I remember this time, I was young, a postdoc and us, and there was kind of a silence in the turbulence community because everybody wanted to say what a nonsense, and nobody would kind of, had courage. So I took it upon myself to say what a nonsense. I wrote a remark on it, and I had a very nice argument for a couple of years with Polyakov. That, and then at some point I started saying maybe it's not at all, because the way that he wrote it, it looked like a total nonsense for anybody who knows fluid mechanics. But Polyakov is actually much deeper than that. He meant something, and he did not care about giving us our details right. So it took me 13 years, from 93 to 2006, to actually understand. We still disagree completely, because he thinks that everything is conformally invariant. And every time I'm trying to tell Sasha, it's not even scale invariant. He said, no, you just don't look deep enough. So the state of the art is like this. Actually, his work is what inspired me, well, at least what kind of bothered me for many years, because I saw that maybe there is something more than just, my sin. Because on the face of it was very easy to explain to him that literally what he wrote was incorrect. But deep down, of course, he was right. There was this conformal invariance hidden, and we eventually found at least one aspect of it. And then we made him happy. Sure, that's something. It feels like a sad silence. Oh, it's deep and slow.
Is this written up in the book?
Yes, part of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the language of this.